Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team. Welcome back to the Predictable Revenue Podcast. I'm your co-host, Colin Stewart. Today, I'm joined by cardboard cutout Aaron, just the top quarter of his head. And our next guest is the VP sales at a fairly large software company that you've probably heard of. And her superpower is forecasting their bookings within 1% of revenue. And you might say, okay, that sounds all right. But then you learn that their revenue run rate is, what is it, Jamie? Half a billion this year?
Half a billion, 500 million. Yep.
Wow. So welcome to the podcast, Jamie Buss. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Colin. Excited to be here. Appreciate it.
I'm really looking forward to diving into this. Anytime we get into sort of sales process and qualification and how that relates to forecasting, I get really excited because something I've done very poorly in the past as a sales rep, you know, and fought back against all of the, you know, all the extra process and work that I thought my sales manager was forcing on me. And now that to be on the other side of it and to see the actual power and impact that the forecasting can have on a business has been incredible. So I'm really looking forward to diving in. Before we jump into Zendesk, because you have a pretty defined methodology that we're going to go through in a little bit. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about your story. How did you get to Zendesk? Where were you before?
Yeah. So rather than kind of go back all the way back, let's just go back one job from here. So prior to Zendesk, I worked at a little known venture capital firm called Andreessen Horowitz, which I'm sure your audience is probably fairly familiar with. Funny story, I was working at a startup just prior to that, and I was 6 months pregnant at the time and not looking for a job. And I had a recruiter reach out to me on LinkedIn and said, hey, there's this opportunity at A16Z. Would you be interested in talking? And my first response was, what the heck would A16Z want with a salesperson? I didn't really understand their model. And once, fortunately, even though I was 6 months pregnant, kind of waddled my way into the interview and fortunately got the job. And some of the audience also might be familiar with Mark Cranny. So he was the operating partner at the time for working under Mark and Ben, and he headed up the market development team there. And our edict was really to help startups with their go-to-market strategies. So a lot of the times, startup companies are technical founders, because A16Z primarily only invested in technical founders, didn't understand or have familiarity with, how do I build a comp plan? Who's my first sales hire? Do I start with a VP? Do I start with a rep? What's a fair quota? There's all these things that when you're in sales, you think are, you know, pretty straightforward, if you will. But when you're a technical founder, you're good at developing software and solving people's problems. You're not really good at figuring out how to hire salespeople. So we built a lot of programs to help them. And in one of these programs, we did a sales boot camp. And in one of those sections was on forecasting. And Mark and I would actually fight over one slide in this deck, because he would always say that forecasting, the forecast call, was basically a waterboarding exercise of really drilling into the reps. And I was like, Mark, we can't put that on the slide. Like, we can't do that. Man, we've got a big audience. We can't put a waterboarding picture on the slide. So I won, and so we ended up with an interrogation slide of someone sitting kind of, you know, with a light bulb over their head. But then he would always be sore to point out during the presentation that that's not the slide that he wanted to demonstrate this. But in if he listens to this, he'll get a chuckle out of that, I'm sure. But what he
should have done, a live demonstration.
Yeah. Right. Oh my gosh. He would have, he completely would have been on board with that. But what he really walked through was how important a sales process and then a qualification methodology are in order to forecast properly and predictably. And I don't think I appreciated it as much at the time. Like, I understood what he was saying, but then when I got, you know, I can kind of walk through what happened when I got to Zendesk, and that's when the light bulb went off and I was like, oh my gosh, I get what Mark was saying. That is a big gap that we have here. So I had a phenomenal opportunity at A16Z, and I think it really helped me kind of launch into my career here at Zendesk.
Right on. I can't even begin to imagine what it would have been like working under Mark. I mean, I remember reading the Hard Thing About Hard Things and thinking, yep, this guy is the central figure, at least in my book, you know, in my eyes, as the sort of hero of the book.
Yeah, no, he literally, I think it's around page 90 in The Hard Thing of Hard Things is where the kind of the section about Mark is. And he's really kind of a larger than life character, if you are, a person in the book. But I mean, he is in real life too. I mean, I agreed with pretty much everything that he would, how he'd want us to do things. And, you know, he's not afraid to tell you if you haven't done well. I remember many a meeting where I'd come in with an email that I wanted to send out for something or other. And he'd look at it and he'd take it and he'd tear it up. And he'd throw it out in the middle of the room and he'd go spin again. It's not where it needs to be. So he was definitely not afraid to share his opinion, but I think, you know, what it did is it taught me, he taught me a lot about enterprise sales. Mark is very, very good at the top down enterprise sales model, selling to the C-level, really establishing the value, how you go against the competition. I don't really know that there's a better general out there. You want to go into war, you want Mark Crane at the helm, because I think he really, you know, he knows how to build a scalable sales structure. Because it's one thing if you hire one great rep, sure, you're going to do okay. But what you need to be able to do is not everyone's going to be an A+. How do you hire a B+ or B player and get them to perform as an A player? You have to have a program that you can plug them into through onboarding, training, and then a sales process that is readily accessible to everyone. Because there's no one on the planet who can hire all A players. You can tell me, I've got a team of all A players, no one does. So the only way to mitigate that is to have a process that you can plug good people into and help them be superstars. And you know, I think that's what really hit home with me.
Mm-hmm. I love the piece on taking sort of great, like good people and helping them achieve extraordinary results. Mm-hmm. I think that's
a more eloquent way to say it. Thank you, Colin.
So let's talk about, you came to Zendesk, you said there was a bit of a realization. So talk to me about that experience.
So, you know, for me, I'm definitely more like, so Mark is top down enterprise, large deal. And I think where I shine is definitely more, higher volume or process is really important. So I do better when it's a bottoms up where you have to complement that with a top down. And that's very much a Zendesk history, right? So if you look at what we do, I mean, we're a customer support software platform. We started off selling to SMBs and startups primarily over the web. So all of the infrastructure, all the sales processes were really built with that as its inception. And that happens to a lot of companies where, you know, everyone wants things built without having to have sales involved. Everyone wants to be Atlassian. I can't tell you how many times I hear that, right? Well, you can get to a point with that, but then eventually you have to start layering in salespeople, and then you have to go up market, right? So the nice thing about being at a bottoms up company is that you can take everything you've learned about ease of deployment and less friction in the sales cycle and start applying that to the Fortune 1000, Fortune 500. So when I got here, what was so different for me, and I know there's a slide you're referring to where I really felt like Dorothy and like I'm not in Kansas anymore. Because when I looked at what I was forecasting, I realized I had a big number to forecast, but I had two different elements that made it up. I had a tremendous amount of quarter and quarter business that wasn't in my funnel today that was going to make up part of that closed business. Then I had a pipeline of larger opportunities, call them, you know, 6K ARR and up. I had a big funnel of those, but then I'd be in forecast calls with those opportunities and I'd be listening to what the reps were saying about it. And I'd be like, oh my God, this isn't a commit deal. What is it? This isn't going to happen. this is not a deal for this quarter. It might be a real deal, but it's definitely not a deal for this quarter. So I had to come up with a way of combining forecasting the long tail, which I'm not going to get into now. I'm not the ops person. So I have an ops person that helps me do that. And that's a lot of trends and analysis to figure out, okay, if we look at the business by new, by expansion, and by deal size, how has it been trending quarter over quarter and year over year? What is the headcount we've put against it? And then what is the expected return of those headcount investment and the growth we expect in that kind of quarter and quarter business? So that's a definitely more operational kind of math exercise. I need to complement that with the deals that are actually in my pipeline. And then I have to figure out, well, how many of those are going to close? Because that's going to add up to be the total. And I think for me, that was the one part of I wasn't in Kansas anymore. How do I marry those two things? And then once I really got into the pipeline, I realized the team did not have Like if someone were to tell me something was in stage two, that meant different things to different people. Stage three meant different things to different people. We weren't speaking the same language. So I needed to come up with a common language that the whole sales team could use for both sales process and qualification methodology, so that when I was asking people doing the waterboarding exercise in a forecast call, that when I asked them about stage three, we all knew what that meant. And it was very, it was a lot easier for me than to predict, okay, now I can apply some probabilities to my sales stages and really start to assess what is going to be my conversion rate out of my existing opportunities based on how far along they are in the funnel.
It's amazing the impact that having that common language to communicate with the whole team, the impact that can have. Mm-hmm. I've lived in situations where, just like you, we're calling stage two dramatically different things. And I know, you know, I'm sitting across the table at another rep and I'm like, I know your stage two is just all garbage. Like my stage two actually means something. And I felt bad for, you know, the VP at the end of the table trying to make sense of what we're talking about. Cause like, I know I'm going to hit my quota. Cause I don't care about his quota, but I know I'm going to hit mine. And I know his pipeline is made up of magic fairy dust and unicorns and all these mythical creatures that it's not going to turn into dollars on his paycheck.
Yep. No, that's absolutely true. So I feel so much more confident in our deals. And it actually gave our reps a lot more confidence too, because now when they look and they see, if they start off the quarter and a good deal amount of their deals are in stage three or four, they can feel a lot more confident in their commit. So one thing I noticed is that the team commits very conservatively, right? They're almost committing their worst case. And I have to kind of force them to be like, okay, I understand there's risk, but I need you to commit a higher number and then articulate to me what that risk is. But I can't have you come in and forecast your worst case, because I barely need a rep to cover that worst case. I need you to fill the gap between that and where you need to get to. So, you know, walk me through that. So I think we're definitely getting better at that. But without having that common language, I don't think it wouldn't have been possible. It's just the data was almost meaningless. There was a deal with opportunity with a MRR, monthly recurring revenue associated to it. That's kind of all I had. Right. So in any case, and we can kind of walk through the details of when we're ready here to kind of walk through what that sales process is. I think we did something a little different there too, that really helped us compared to what I'd done in the past.
I'd love to learn more. So tell me about this process. Where does it start? What's involved?
Yeah. So one of the things that I've always done prior to my tenure at Zendesk was sales stages were always about what we had done. What had the sales rep done, or what did the sales rep confirmed? So did the sales rep qualify the deal? Did the sales rep attend the discovery call? And what really kind of dawned on me here was, you know what? It does matter what we do, but what's more important is what was the customer verifiable outcome that we really are at the stage we thought we were going to, what we think we're at. So for example, if it's qualification, which for me is actually stage one in an omit, I don't put qualification stage into my active funnel. That's where I put my deals that my SDR team, we have an awesome SDR team here led by amazing leaders who do a really, really good job of both. We have outbound and inbound split, much more efficient. I changed that this year, which I know from Aaron's book, you should have had it split. I had some reasons as to why I wasn't allowed to split it last year, but we split it and we really did truly get a 25% efficiency gain by having my SDR split. So when they find an opportunity, they put it in a stage one. It's an omit for me in my forecast category. And then what the customer verifiable outcome for them is that the customer attends the meeting and they agree to the next step of the discovery call. So it seemed that stage is pretty straightforward. Motherhood and apple pie, there's nothing too fancy there. We move on to discovery. That's what that's the first call that one of my sales team is going to take, right? So one of my closing reps is going to take the discovery call. So, you know, which key stakeholders attend that discovery call? Is it just somebody who's an influencer, or who from that call actually attends? And even if the stakeholders don't attend, as we exit that discovery call, have the stakeholders agreed to the demo or to the next call in the next kind of meeting in our sales process? And then we kind of agree to what our next step in our plan is from there. So those are all things that we can then send as an email post discovery call. Thank you, Mr. or Ms. Customer, for your time today. Here's our next step. And here's a summary of what we've learned about your environment. Please send us if there's anything that we missed. right? And that's something the customer can write back and say, great, looks good. We're looking forward to meeting with you on X date for the demo. That to me is a customer verifiable outcome. Yes, we attended the call, but the customer agreed. We captured the right information and agreed to get the right people on the demo. So stage three for us, solution review and then solution validation stage four. So for solution review, that's my stage three. And this is a very, very critical stage for us because the customer verifiable outcome for me on stage three is that do nothing is off the table. So if ever I see a stage four deal, my first question to the rep is, why is do nothing off the table? Because for us as salespeople, yes, we have a lot of competition. We're in a market where there's a lot of competition, but everyone's competition and the biggest one every time is do nothing. Because they probably have something in place today. And even if it's painful to use, it's still an option to continue using whatever they're using today, even if it's email in our case, right? So how do I know that the customer feels that the pain is great enough that they say, no, absolutely, we need to do something. And then we also need to confirm that our technical requirements are met. So have we met the requirements of the cut? Now, we don't have the technical win yet, but at least do we understand what those technical requirements are? And we'll go through a bit when we go into MedPIC on that.
And just a question on solution, sort of between discovery and solution review, where does the demo sort of fit in here?
So usually when they're in stage three, that's when the demo is taking place. That's where we're really setting up to win technically. So sometimes we have to do a short trial with them. So we have a downloadable trial. So sometimes they'll want to do that. Sometimes it's a series of different stakeholders that need to meet and are interested in our product from different perspectives. And so we need to meet with security, or we need to meet with IT, and we need to meet with the line of business. And there's a lot of different people that we need to get on board with our solution. So stage three is where all that is happening, right? It's where we're understanding what that decision criteria and decision process is. Decision process is kind of after we know, we're kind of doing that in parallel, but we need to understand how are we going to win this deal technically, because that is a very important part of the win. And then how do we win it from a business perspective as well? So that's really happening kind of in that stage three is a very heavy stage for me. There's a lot going on in it, which means that's when I know when I've gone to stage four, that's how I know I'm in a much better position to get that deal. If it sits in stage three for a long time, that, you know, I would never put a stage three in a commit, right? Maybe a best case if I know enough about the deal and how far along we are. But a stage three is best case at best from my perspective as a VP.
Yeah, that's fair. And just to drill in on confirming do nothing is off the table, can you give me like an example of how some of your reps have found that?
Yep. It actually is going to tie into MedPIC a little bit. So I don't want to jump ahead too much, but okay. To give you a preview of where we're going to go in the qualification methodology, because you got to think about it. The qualification methodology stripes across the sales process, right? So if you have not identified the pain, and then I had someone said once, you know, if you haven't like poked and prodded at that pain till the customer's actually bleeding, then they probably don't feel it well, and like they don't feel it enough that they're willing to make a change. So you really have to identify, especially if it was even an inbound, well, what made them reach out to Zendesk? What was the reason? What is the pain they're currently feeling? What is their as-is state? Where are they at currently? Where would they like to be, right? In terms of a bunch of their metrics. Again, that's right. The first letter in MedPIC is going to be the metrics, right? So if we can then quantify that do nothing is actually more expensive to their P&L than moving forward with us, that's where I think that we can get past that do nothing is an option. But they've got to agree that the as-is state is no longer sustainable from either a process standpoint, but more importantly, a bottom line perspective, right? Because there's a lot of things Zendesk can do to help them with customer sat, with response time, resolution time that actually can make an impact to returning customers and or customer satisfaction as a whole, which of course people are very concerned about their brands. So it's kind of hard to kind of go into deep detail without, I can give you kind of examples of the pain that we are able to cover through our product, but it's really about making it acute enough and quantifying dollars to it. Because if you can't quantify dollars to prove that do nothing is more expensive. It's always on the table.
I think that solves it. It's the rep having, like, forcing the reps to have that conversation and to know that piece of information, that the logical thing to do here is to, you know, they're going to save X, they're going to earn Y, they're going to reduce, you know, headcount by, or the necessary headcount by, you know, Z to, you know, by implementing this solution. So you're saying it's knowing that piece and knowing that going with us or another solution is going to be a better alternative than doing nothing.
Yes. And it's better for their P&L. So that means you really have to do, when you're in the discovery phase, you really have to understand what is the as is state. What are they using today? What are the other products that they're using? What, in our terminology, we say swivel chair. So if they're using a ton of different products to do all support, then the poor support person is swiveling between applications, and a lot of efficiency is lost with them trying to do that. We actually had a recent win with a customer who, you know, the pain they were feeling was they would have customers come in through all these different channels, chat, phone, web. And it would be the same customer because they wouldn't respond on phone because their phone lines were overloading. So then they chat, no one respond on chat. Then they'd come in through email. The company had no idea of knowing that if me, Jamie Buss, is trying to reach this client through all these different channels, they had no idea that it was me, the same person, trying to reach them on these different channels. So, you know, they were trying to look at customer service as a differentiator. They wanted more people to come to them directly, not have to buy so, sell so much through third parties. But to do it, be a destination, they had to have better customer support. And they realized what we did is we helped them quantify how much money they were potentially losing by not being able to triage these issues in a timely fashion, and how much they were losing at a cart drop off because people are trying to ask questions about shipping or whatnot before they were even purchasing. So we were able to drill down and quantify how much is this costing you. The swivel chair is, yes, a problem for your agents, but it's a bigger problem for your company because you're losing customers because you're not answering them in a timely fashion.
Beautiful. So now that you've nailed the, it's more expensive to do nothing. So what's next in your sales process?
Yeah. So stage four, we know do nothing is off the table, and we've pretty much confirmed we've met the technical requirements. We might not have won yet against the competition. So a lot of times in stage four, it's usually me and one other company left standing if I haven't yet won it. And at that point, I need to confirm technical selection and then business selection. And I also, so that's basically doing the ROI, TCO justification, especially depending on who I'm with or who I'm up against. And then I'm also at the same time as trying to get the business and the technical win, I'm also laying out, as per, we use MedPick with a P. I know a lot of people don't use the P. We'll get into that. But I also have to ensure, what is the paper process going to be after this? Because I cannot forecast accurately if I don't know how many different documents are we going to have to get signed? Who are all the different signatories for each of those? Are all those people available? And is there an order of operation that has to happen? Some of our clients need to issue POs. Not everyone does, but if they have to issue a PO, they might have to sign the service order first. That has to go for a certain route of approval. Then they need to issue a PO, which is sometimes a different route of approval. Then we might have a statement of work that has to get signed, and then we might have negotiated an MSA. So it can get pretty complicated, and my team wasn't really nailing down what were all the specific people involved in each of those steps. So without really understanding the paper process, I wasn't necessarily losing deals, but I was misforecasting the date. So that's something we're also we're uncovering as we're trying to nail down that we are in fact going to win technically. A lot of the times customers will ask us for concessions and whatnot because we're also negotiating the MSA at this point as well. And I'm like, I'm happy to make that, but you need to confirm in writing that we're the technical selection before I'm willing to go do that. So, yeah. So does that kind of help in the solution review phase or the solution validation phase?
Yeah. Solution validation. It's basically you're confirming the selection criteria. You're confirming the sort of what the next step process is because it sounds like it's a two part sort of stage for you. It's one, let's confirm that we know what the right criteria are that they're going to base their technical decision on. Mm-hmm. And then sort of beyond that. Okay. So now we've confirmed that we can meet those criteria. Let's understand what the paper, like, let's assuming this is going to close, let's see how long it's going to take to close so that we can accurately put that in the right bucket, whether it's month or quarter.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's exactly right. And I could be a little bit more aggressive with you know, stage, sometimes I'll let things sit in stage four a little bit, even if we've won technically, only because I think the paper process is going to push me. And I go, if we haven't nailed down, if we've won technically, but the team has not nailed down the paper process, I make them figure that out before I let them flip that into stage five. Because once it's in stage five, I want that close date to be like the day it's closing. Right. And, the, and we should know that by then, but you have to reverse engineer that based on where are we, like, what's all this paperwork that has to be done and be negotiated and then back into it. So that's really at the point, like when it's by stage five, I should know the date. Now with some of the larger companies, we've missed some of those sometimes because they'll have a process change on them that our champion wasn't aware of. And if that happens, I have missed forecasted deals by the date sometimes because of that, but then we have lesson learned and it doesn't happen the next time.
Yeah.
So yeah. And so stage five verbal contracting is literally getting through the contract negotiation phase at that point. Typically we've agreed to price. If they ask for some concessions within the, sometimes there's commercial terms, as we all know, there's commercial terms buried in the MSA that then come back. And so there's some further negotiation that oftentimes happens in stage five, because if I'm making other concessions, then I might take something else away, or, you know, what's my get for that? Because, but most of the time we're commercially nailed down outside of whatever kind of commercial terms need to be negotiated on the.
So outside of price, what other types of commercial terms will you sort of negotiate on? Like, what are the common ones? I love that face.
Well, I mean, there's a number of them, right? When you're going up market, there's several of them that I won't do that are asked for all the time. And when I'm involved in it directly, I'll be very straightforward. I'm like, you know, we're not going to do term for convenience, because that just turned my multi-year deal into a monthly deal, because I can only recognize that monthly. Because if you can term your contract at any time, that means my company cannot take revenue except on a monthly basis. And if any customer wants to do that, they can. It's called a monthly plan at list price. So term for convenience is oftentimes one that comes up, but it just doesn't make sense for our company to be able to do that. Indemnification always comes up. So there's always conversations around that, and indemnity caps, liability caps. Let me see. There's other ones once we go up market, where companies will have specific downtime requirements. I'm very careful about what we commit to on. We very rarely have scheduled downtime, but as a SaaS company, I have 125,000 customers. So we've got to be really careful about what we do as a special term on that front for customers, because I can't have 2,000 different agreements of what we'll do with them. So they'll oftentimes ask for that. And it's usually companies that aren't usually used to buying SaaS, or they're larger, more traditional. And they're like, well, these are the dates that we can't have anything happen. And we've got some nice language that we use to address that. That usually helps us out, but that's often a common question, because we're selling to traditional retail or traditional manufacturing. And, you know, there's peak periods for everyone. Of course, there's Christmas and Valentine's Day and all that kind of stuff. So that's another common one for us that I'm sure some of the SaaS audience probably experiences as well. So,
Okay. So to exit contract, or the contract verbal stage, so stage five, you've got, is this a verbal go ahead? Is this a signature? Is this cash in the bank? Like, what are we talking here?
Oh, so to move from basically from five to six, we need the signed service order and the signed services agreement if we've negotiated it. A lot of times we have an online agreement, but if the deal is large enough or the company is strategic enough, then we'll do the negotiated contract. Once we have those two things signed, and if there's a statement of work, we'll want to get that signed as well for our services. Once we have all those in signed, then that goes into stage six, and then finance takes over from there and verifies everything's copacetic, and then they put it into stage seven, which I think is officially closed one, but sales can't do that. It's just finance kind of checks all the boxes that all the documentation is accurate. So stage six is basically as far as we can do. Unless it fails finance because there's some small thing, and then we might need to correct something and then resubmit it to them. But in any case, once it's stage six, we're pretty much done with that deal and moving on to the next one.
Cool. So we've got So you qualify, then we do discovery. Solution review is where we confirm nothing's off the table. Solution mm-hmm. validation confirms the technical selection criteria and the process, the paper process, the stage five contracting and verbal basically confirms that we're the chosen winner, signing all the appropriate documents. And then we move it to stage six, and that's when finance takes over and starts yep. extracting money from the other organization, basically.
That's right. Yeah. And then that goes to whatever their payment terms are and all that kind of stuff.
And so I feel like this is where most companies end. Like we've gotten very detailed, you know, more than most companies I've worked at, into like what each of these stages means and what it means to move to the next stage. So you tell me there's a whole other process on top of this sales process.
Yeah, I know it might sound a little bit heavyweight, but what you need, at least for what I feel you need on top of this is, well, what's the qualification methodology? Because the qualification methodology is striped across this. So some of what I'll walk you through when I walk through MedPIC is going to be what you heard me say through the sales process. The sales process is really about the customer verifiable outcome. They've told us they've won. I have it in writing that I've won technically, or I have it in writing that we've won the business and we're moving forward with contracting. But for the team, so I'm a very process-oriented person. That's probably why I do well in a higher volume type of environment. I tend to think of things of how do I have coverage on the business? Do I have the right troops? Do I have the right kind of troops? Do I have the energy focused in the right way? And it's very exciting for me to be in that type of environment. But it's also because it is so fast-paced, I felt like the team needed a way of scoring their opportunities in terms of how qualified it was, right? I actually think you can do this for accounts too. I haven't thought about that in depth, but I kind of feel like I need this accounts because, you know, you mentioned most people, things are over at the end of the stage. Well, we're SaaS, and so we're never done. We're account managers and we're hunters. We've got to be both. We don't have that split here. So we're doing both account growth. We're doing expansion as well as new business and on a territory basis. So how do we know the health of that opportunity? How qualified is it really? Well, the sales stage doesn't really tell you that. So what MedPIC does, and it did come out of PTC ages ago, so this is not a new methodology. I think you and I talked a little bit about that. Not necessarily new. What we've done is we've added an extra C and we've added a P, but I'll walk you through some of how Zendesk thinks about these things and how I've actually brought it to life and applied a score to it that really helps us even forecast more accurately in combination with the stage. So metrics is a really important aspect. It's where MedPIC starts, right? It's the metrics. It's how do you quantify success for the customer? So for us, I will use this as a prime example. You know, what are they currently gathering? What metrics are they gathering today that they're not happy with? So for example, I mentioned it a little bit earlier, response time. So how long is it taking your customer service representatives to respond back to a customer request? And then how about resolution time? How long is it taking them from the time they first get the ticket to the time the customer says, yes, you've resolved my issue? A lot of times customers have SLAs that are associated with this that they need to meet. And then of course, customer satisfaction. We do also do internal use cases as well. So we will support IT and HR. And in fact, we drink a ton of our own champagne. Every time I have a legal negotiation, it's on a ticket. If I have a new hire and I need to process their new hire, it's on a ticket. So we basically do everything on tickets outside of, you know, we are Salesforce customers as well for SFA. But other than that, for process related things, we use tickets. And what the customers, we help them understand is, all right, what is that as is state right now with you? What are the metrics you're currently gathering? And what do you want it to be? So if your response time is X, you want it to be Y. Okay, great. If your current customer C stat is this and you want it to move it to that. So then what we do is we really map out for them the kind of their as is and to be state. And that to be state is really what we'll anchor on. And then we'll want to quantify that for them as well so that they can start understanding how is this going to impact the business, which is going to lead into the I, which is the identified pain. So the metrics and the identified pain are very closely related. So if I take the identified pain and kind of metrics a step further, let's take that SLA as an example. Okay, how do I make that a pain point? Some of our customers have SLAs that if they're not met, they're like charged a fine. So that's a very easy quantifiable way of saying, well, let's see how many SLAs you're missing on a monthly basis. And how much is that costing you today? And if we're able to increase that SLA, because a lot of the time what we do is we have a help center that can help, that's like a knowledge base that helps your customers, but it can also be agent facing as well. So we can put that knowledge at your agent fingertips and allow them to decrease and meet or exceed their SLAs almost every time, which would then result in you saving X, Y, or Z based on that. So that's an example of how you really need to pick until you really can unpack, how can I make this into a dollar value? Because if they don't feel the dollar value of that identified pain, you might have a pending event, but like a renewal of a competitor is not a pending event because they can do nothing. They can renew the contract, right? Mm-hmm. But how do you make it painful enough that renewing that contract is no longer an option? You have to make it affect the bottom line, because the CFO is going to care about that. Everyone's going to care about that, right? Not just the VP of support, but that goes all the way up through C-level. So metrics and identified pain are very, very closely related. And if that identified pain isn't strong enough, we won't win the deal. There's three things in here. I'll walk you through all of them, but there's three of these metrics that I believe if you do not have nailed down, I know I'm not going to win. And identified pain is definitely one of them. There's deals where I've walked through and forecast. I'm trying to think of, you know, some recent ones where I can tell right off the bat that there's not a strong enough pain for, we haven't created it. We haven't done a good enough job of digging deep enough to find what the true quantifiable issue is. So going back to kind of the med pick in order. So that was metrics tied a bit to identified pain as well.
Mm-hmm. And with metrics, just before we jump into economic buyer, sure. So metrics, what you're really looking for is sort of a delta between reality and their expectations.
Mm-hmm. Or right? Goal, their desired state, right? Perfect. Here's your reality. Here's your desired state. And can we quantify what that looks like for you? So oftentimes what we'll do is when we gather this through our discovery phase, when we go and do our demo presentation, we will have a slide that says, here's what we heard from you on what's happening today. Mm-hmm. And here's what we heard from you on where you'd like to be. Now we're going to walk you through how Zendesk can help you get there.
Gotcha.
And it makes it very relevant. Obviously, there's a lot of teaming that goes on between my sales team and usually a customer support manager or someone on that side who really understands the business from that perspective. And they'll usually kind of tag team on this information before we even get to that presentation phase and demo phase with the stakeholders. So that's a really important part for us. And as we get in later in the deal too, we'll also do ROI, return on investment, or total cost of ownership. Because we do tend to need less administrative support. We do tend to, like, we've had clients that we can get up and running in 2 months and we've beat the competition because there's just no way that we can meet the time frame. But that's another metric, right? Mm-hmm. Timing. You need to have this up and running in 2 months. Walk me through how so-and-so competitor unnamed is going to be able to do that, because we can walk you through that right now. So it really kind of depends on the deal and the metrics. The tough thing about metrics is it can be very different. It's really hard to say it's always this, this, or this. Mm-hmm. You really need the reps to ask good discovery and pull on the threads of the conversation so that they can uncover what those metrics are for that client, because that's not a one size fits all.
Because it seems like the metrics is where you're looking for the, like, a delta between the numbers, right? This is where you're able to quantify certain things. Yes. But with identifiable pain, that's when you're trying to put those metrics into the context of this buyer. Mm-hmm. Some of your customers might not care when they start. You know, it could be this year, it could be next year. But if some have some certain event in 2 months, then that's going to be the forefront of the deal, because, you know, if you can't do it, well, that's a deal killer.
Yes, that's cool. Exactly right.
So it's MEDDPICC.
Mm-hmm. Yep,
okay. So we've done M, we sort of skipped to I because the two are really related.
Yeah.
You've told me that there's a third one that's hiding in here that's really important. Let's keep that open loop. We'll move on to E.
Okay. We'll move on to E, which happens to be one of the third legs of the stool of the most important.
There we go.
So, you have to know the other ones, obviously, but, economic buyer, all right. So When I first went into Zendesk, was kind of doing the forecast calls with the deals, you know, I would ask, well, who's making the decision here, right? You've got people say, who's the decision maker? That's a little bit too obtuse for me. The economic buyer, and then people would say, well, my economic buyer, well, he holds the budget or she holds the budget. Like, that's not an economic buyer. Mm-hmm. Give you an example of an economic buyer. If I own a budget, which I do here at Zendesk, there's a budget I own and there's a budget I have to ask for. Okay. So in some instances, I am the economic buyer if you're going to sell to me, because I do own a budget. I do own a P&L for all of North America. And within that budget, I can fit certain things. In that case, you don't need approval from anyone else. I'm the economic buyer, because if I don't have the money for this project, I can decide, you know what? I can hold off on holding this I can hold off hiring this SDR headcount for two more quarters, which buys me this amount of money, which means I can bring that forward and move it over to cover this SaaS purchase. Okay. That makes me an economic buyer, because not only do I have access to budget, but I can move money. I can create budget where there wasn't budget before. That is the key to having an economic buyer. When people are trying to sell to me, I'll tell them, listen, in this scenario, I'm not the economic buyer because I don't have the money. So that means I'm going to have to pitch this. I need you to help me sell this. I need a deck that'll help me sell this to my SVP, because I don't have budget for this, but I think it's really important we do that for the sales team. I'm actually in the process of doing that right now. It's a training engagement I want to get for the team. It's too much money. I don't have it. In that case, I can be a champion, which we'll get to later, but I'm not the economic buyer. So what I engage with the team is three stages. Do you know who the economic buyer is? Yes or no? Have you met with them, or do you have a relationship with the economic buyer? Right? So what we'll get to it is I actually score each of these in Salesforce a one, a zero, a one, or a 2 points. So zero is you don't know who they are. And that's okay, because the whole point of MedPick is understanding where your holes are. So as you go through the sales process, you can fill the holes, right? So I'm not trying to get people in trouble by not knowing these things. I just want to know we don't know it so we can find it out. So it's economic buyer is a zero if we don't know who they are. It's a one if we know who they are but have no relationship. And it's a two if we know who they are and I could call them, right? We have a relationship with them where I can actually reach out and they will respond back to me. So that would be a two. But if you don't have that relationship with the economic buyer, then your competitor is going to come in and sell to them, and they're going to go top down on you, and you're going to be a bottoms up sale selling from, you know, the end users, and they're going to come in top down and they're going to swipe you out of the deal. And that happens to us sometimes when we haven't gotten to the economic buyer. I've gotten outmaneuvered by the competition and it kills me. So now we try to make sure we're very conscious of, do we know who that person is? Why are they the economic buyer? And then how do we get that relationship with them? That's also a way when we get to champion, how you can test that champion. How willing are they to get you in front of, to willing to disclose and willing to get you an audience with that economic buyer?
And I think that's really the crux of why this can be so important for a salesperson to have something like this. Because if you're going to get blindsided, if you're going to lose a deal, you may as well know why you're going to lose the deal ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Right? And,
yep.
And having this in front of you, it's sort of like doing that, like, somebody calls them a pre-mortem. I can't remember. It's a thought leader. I've heard it a bunch of times, but knowing if you think ahead, okay, if I'm going to lose this deal, why am I going to lose this deal? And then I try and actively work to try and figure out where my holes are and what I can do about it.
Yep. That's exactly right. That this helps you identify the holes, because you're going to have them. And in fact, once I MedPicked, there was a deal I was very actively involved with last summer. And once I thoroughly MedPicked it, I did it myself and I MedPicked it. And I'm like, I'm not going to win this deal. And even though I was told by the economic buyer that I had won the deal and we were negotiating the contract, I still did not feel good about it. I didn't have a strong champion. The relationship with the economic buyer, I didn't trust it. I knew the competitor was in there. I knew the economic buyer had gone with the competitor at a different company. And I knew my score on the EB and the champion was very low. And I'm like, and then everyone's like, yeah, but you've been told you've won. I'm like, I don't think we're going to win it. And then they went quiet for 3 weeks. Before that had even happened, I closed it out. And everyone thought I was crazy for losing this opportunity. I might close it out. I don't want the sales team spending time on it. It's done. We're moving on. We're not going to win this thing. 2 weeks after I did that, I get a call from the VP who says, you know, I'm really sorry. I'm sure you're probably assuming this is not good news. And unfortunately, it's not good news. I've loved working with you, but unfortunately, we've gone in a different direction. And I was not surprised. I was not surprised because I was not in a good position in that deal and I didn't want to spend a ton more time on it because I just knew I was losing. Even though it had seemed on the surface I was winning, I wasn't winning. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Would you ever be so bold to call that out in a deal with a prospect?
This, I would. This situation, I don't want to get too much in the personal detail of the client. There were some personal things going on with the client personally, that it was not appropriate for me to necessarily have that conversation. But in a normal circumstance, when I have that relationship with them, I have no problem asking. And I've done that several times, even of late, when people are not, listen, like if you guys have gone in a different direction at this point, I would appreciate knowing. Mm-hmm. Because that's fine. I have plenty of other people to be working with. But yeah, I mean, I actually have had to ask that recently as this week of, you know, not getting the response we're looking for. I do have something I can discuss with them, but like, if that's not the direction they're going, I'd rather just have them tell me, because I don't want to spend time where it's where I'm just not going to be able to turn it around.
I'd say it's almost my favorite thing is to lose a deal early, before we've invested way too much time, or not early, but at the right time. I think my mm-hmm. second favorite thing is winning a deal. And I'd only say first favorite thing is losing a deal at the right time, is because you're going to lose way, way more than you're going to win. And so just, it's going to work out timing wise way better.
I know. I do hate losing anytime, but if it's going to happen, I'd rather not spend a ton of time on it. So I completely agree with you there. And I think mm-hmm. this helps. Right? I think this helps kind of flesh that stuff out. So economic buyer, I think that, any other questions on that? I think that kind of is the key, is who can move the money.
I think that makes sense. Yeah.
Yep. So decision criteria, this is pretty straightforward. This is really the technical requirements you're going to have to meet in order to win the deal. And you're going to have some competition in there, obviously. And you need to understand, what do you do well that the competition can't do? What can the competition do well that you can't do? And where do you guys overlap? And you need to make sure you stay in your quadrant of what you can do that they can't do, and not where it overlaps, because no one wins if you stay in the middle. But as long as you're focusing on where you can win, that sets you up to win. You kind of set the agenda in the account. This is actually a Mark Cranny term. I love it, and I've used it here, but a lockout document or a test plan that you can share with the client if they are going to go into some rigorous testing. Say, hey, listen, I know you're going to want to modify this, but let me just give you a head start on how you can test the product and put it through its paces. Here's a sample test plan that you can modify it to your heart's content, but here's a good starting point. And what I've done is, especially if I know who I'm up against, which I should know by now, then I can set myself up to be successful, because I know where we overlap, where we're different, and really shine what we do well that makes it very hard for the competition. And I know when they've done it to me. I know when I'm in the deal too late. I know when they've gotten in first, and I know when I'm in a beauty contest. And even if I have better security and all this kind of stuff, it's come down to a beauty contest, and I know that I wasn't in first, right? I got invited to that table late, and I didn't set the agenda. And that really puts you back on your heels and doesn't put you in the best position. Going back to how important the SDRs are.
Absolutely. I love our SDRs for getting us into the deals so yes. much earlier. I know some salespeople don't like working outbound deals. I've heard this complaint numerous times that, there's so much work to be done, more work to be done than with an inbound. Man, the pain of going through the beauty pageant.
Well, you're a salesperson. That's your job.
Yeah, exactly. Big fan. So how do you score decision criteria?
This one is a little easier, because if you have to map out what their criteria are and then confirm whether or not. So if you don't know it at all yet because you're too early, that's a zero. Mm-hmm. If you've mapped it out but you haven't met at all, then that probably be a one. If you've mapped it out and you've confirmed with the client that you've met the decision criteria, then that gets a two.
Gotcha.
So it's pretty straightforward on that one.
Okay.
In the decision process, which is the next, so there's two Ds, decision prospect is the second one. And this is really understanding who are all the stakeholders involved. And as you're selling SaaS, I mean, yes, you're going to have an LOB line of business involved in that. But there could be other people. There could be a completely separate security team that's going to be involved. That is a subset of IT. And so then IT gets roped in as well. Maybe there's another business unit. So oftentimes, because we're support, there's a sales group as well that might not be using Zendesk, but support and sales kind of overlap, specifically in the chat arena. So you do have to understand, what is sales using and how are we going to have these two teams collaborate and work well together? And so sales might actually have a seat at the table depending on the decision as well. So decision process is really understanding, who are all those stakeholders and what is their criteria? What is their decision criteria for each of those individuals and make sure that we're meeting that, because they could very much well vary. So knowing the decision process is really that. Understanding, if you don't know it at all, it's a zero. If you know who, if you understand the process and who all the stakeholders are involved, you get a one. And then if you know that, plus you've met the criteria of all of them, then you get a two. You can kind of see how that marches you down the sales stages too. Mm-hmm.
So generally these are fairly sequential then, because
yes, the decision criteria and process, I think, are not all the MedPIC letters are in order. I think it's just they had to make it phonetically work. I wouldn't say MedPIC is in order of the letters, but the letter, yeah, but they're kind of intertwined. But decision criteria and decision process, I think, are kind of the two that are closest.
Okay.
And they're what you would think of in a typical qualification criteria. I think most people think of, you know, decision criteria and decision process as being kind of a lot of that decision process, as well as maybe, because they'll put in decision process as the stakeholders and who needs to approve, but that doesn't take into account the importance of a champion, which we haven't gotten to yet, or an economic buyer. I think those two things are really worth calling out because they're critical.
100%. I feel like one of the biggest mistakes I made early in my sales career was thinking that the decision-making process was totally linear and that it was just single-tracked with one individual buyer. Yes, I've talked to this one person. He's the person that's going to buy from me, and not realizing that there's a technical buyer, there's an economic buyer, there's your champion, there's your users, there's your, you know, a variety of different, you know, ways of looking at it. As opposed to like this linear process of there's one person at the company that's going to buy from me and he's going to personally write the check.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a multi-threaded process for sure. Mm-hmm. It's not a linear. Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm sure I made this same mistake as well when I first started selling in VMware, which was my first true bag carrying role back in 2002. But I kind of quickly learned how many different people could be involved in that. But that's when you end up committing something when you really shouldn't have.
Never done that.
Yeah, I know, right? All right, so decision process, I think we're kind of good on that one. In that paper process, I kind of covered that a bit when we went into the verbal contracting stage. It's really understanding all of the different contracts you're going to need to sign with the customer, and then who needs to be involved in signing them, and what is the sequence of events? Because sometimes those are serial. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it does need to be one, then the next, or sometimes the SO statement of work needs to go to one person, but then the PO and the SO have a different process. So it's really important to understand that, because that'll impact your forecasting. Like I said, we misforecasted a Fortune 500 deal from Q1 to Q2 because our champion was out due to a health problem, came back and said, oh my gosh, our process is completely different than last time, even though we had just sold to them in Q4. So we had to go back to the drawing board, and we did close it at the beginning of this quarter, but we did miss it for the quarter just because their process had changed and our champion didn't even know. Hmm. So there's only so much you can do. But as long as you're asking those questions, I think it's the best you can do for yourself. So paper process, zero is if you don't know what it is. One is that you know everything that has to be signed. And then two is you know what has to be signed in the order of events, and you can very well predict the close date, and you can kind of reverse engineer your close date based on that process.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that goes through med pi. We get to the I, which we kind of got into, earlier, but if you had to pick like the three that are most important, economic buyer is definitely one of them. Identified pain is one of the second leg of the stool there. If you haven't done that, then your biggest competition, which is do nothing, is still on the table. So I think we kind of get into detail of that. I don't want to necessarily beat a dead horse there. But the biggest part of that is you got to quantify it. It's got to have, got to impact their bottom line, their pocketbook somehow. To feel enough pain to move forward. But economic buyer and identified pain have to be on the table. You have to have those in order to win, in my opinion. So I would almost say you could put a multiplier of importance. Like we score these in Salesforce, right? So Salesforce will add all this up for me and give it a score. But identified pain, economic buyer, and then we're going to get to next champion, those should almost have a multiplier on top of them. Because if you don't have those, you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. You're probably not going to win that. You could win that deal, but it's going to become a lot harder. So economic buyer identified pain. So jot those down if you're listening.
and that, we will have a picture of your actual Salesforce that we'll include in the show notes, or at least a link that links in the show notes. And we've got, you know, graphics for some takeaways for everybody. So you can see, you know, the sales process and MedPEC all lined up. Before we move to Champion, how would you score identified pain?
Oh, that's a really good point. So zero, of course, we don't know what it is. So it's the same for everything. One is that we might have uncovered what we think is the reason, the identified pain, but we might not have been able to quantify it yet. Sometimes it takes some further discovery to really understand through their business, how can we make do nothing off the table? So two really means we've identified that pain in such a way that we know do nothing is off the table. That's going to vary for each customer, but two is a very, very strong identified pain. For the example of the one I talked through earlier, for the deal we just recently won, they were literally losing clients because they could not manage their multi-channel. They had to get up in 2 months because they had another buying season coming up and they could not afford to be going through an implementation during a peak season over the summer. So that gave us 2 months for them because they're like literally have their investors breathing down their neck in order for them to make this change. So we knew that this was something they were going to have to do, right? So for me, that would have been a two, especially since I knew I was going to fit their timeline, and that timeline was a big part of their pain. And I knew that there was going to be few vendors who were going to be able to meet their scale and integration requirements in combination with being deployed as quickly as we could do. So we really could meet both of those requirements. So for me on that one, that pain would have been a two, a score of a two.
Or a four.
Or a four. Yeah, that had a lot working in our favor. They don't all work out that way, but that one definitely did. So, I mean, our sales cycles can go anything from like, I think some Fortune 500, it literally has taken us 2 years. And then in some deals, we can close in 2 weeks. So it's all over the place. any other questions on that?
Nope, I think I'm good.
Okay, great. So if we move on to Champion, so economic buyer, identified pain, and then Champion. Those are the three most important, in my opinion, of the MedPEC. Champion was one that when I came in, people would say, oh, well, so-and-so is my champion. And my first question would be, how do you know you're your champion? Well, they really like Zendesk. Like, yeah. I mean, my mom can really like Zendesk, but that doesn't mean she's a champion of Zendesk. Like, that does not necessarily mean, well, they used it at a different company. I said, again, it doesn't mean a champion. So we had to redefine what a champion meant here. And now people really understand what it means. And now they'll admit, you know what? I have to build one. I don't have one yet. And so for us, what a champion is, and I kind of mentioned it to earlier when your prospect of me being the buyer, a champion is someone with power and influence and something to gain. So if I'm going to be a buyer of a training service, then I have some power, right? I own almost half the business of the company. That's a little bit of power. I own a really big team. I have, 170 people on my team. I've got a pretty large team. So that gives me some influence. And I have something to gain because I can prove that, hey, if I implement this training, then my expected outcome is I'm going to increase my six-figure deals by X amount, because this is specifically training us on doing better top-down messaging on our sales. I can't move the money, so I'm not the economic buyer, but I'm a champion because I have all these other things, right? Like, I can articulate why I need it. I've got a need. I've got the influence. I'm one of four VPs of the company. So, I mean, all of those things kind of line up. And then what I need to do is, they need to test me. So what am I willing to do? Am I willing to take that vendor and get them in front of the SVP so that they can pitch their solution if he pushes back? If we're in contract negotiations, they can test me by saying, hey, Jamie, they're asking for this. We just can't do it. Can you go work with your legal and see what's absolute deal killer for us here on this deal, right? That's how you test your champion. Do they get you in front of the economic buyer? Are they willing to get you audience with the CFO if you need to? Like, who are they willing to put you in audience of? And then when you're further in the deal, if you know you have a champion, when you get to those sticking points in the negotiation phase, you can tell your champion, like, listen, I'm literally going to have to walk away from this deal if this stays in the contract. So help me understand what you guys really need so that we can kind of meet in the middle here and then they'll go back and work with their legal. But if you don't have a person with power and influence and something to gain, they're not going to be willing to get you in front of the economic buyer. They're not going to be willing to go to bat for you with legal, because like I've been in deals where the team has said, no, this isn't big enough for us. We're not going to go to legal. I'm like, you don't have a champion, and I'm not going to go do, I don't want to win. I don't want to go fight for this deal either, because we're not going to win internally on their side. Right? Because you need someone to sell internally for you. And if you don't have that, then you're going to have to agree to everything on the legal terms, which I, which we can't do. So having that champion, has been key for me deciding on how we move forward on deals, and have we tested that champion and have they delivered? Then I'm a lot more confident going into that negotiation phase.
I love how you've made it quantifiable. Something that's most salespeople are like, yes, I have, you know, it's John, you know, him and I are buddy, you know, we read the same books, like the same sports team, but it's not necessarily, you know, that's not necessarily the case. Is do they have power, influence, and something to gain? Like three very simple criteria. So moving into scoring this, what is, how do you score that one?
Yeah. So, zero, we don't have a champion. We might have, an influencer or a coach, which are still great. We love those. We love our coaches. But we might not have a champion yet. That would be a zero. If we've started to build our, if we have, we believe we have a champion, but we have not tested them, then I would give that a score of a one. We believe it's a power and influence, but we've not tested to see if they're actually willing to go bat for us. I'd give that a score of a one. If we, they have power, they have influence, and they've tested them and they've delivered, I would give that a two, because that gives me a lot of confidence. If I've got the relationship with the economic buyer, I have an identified pain that takes do nothing off the table, and I've got a champion who's willing to go to bat for me, I'm in really good shape on that deal. Mm-hmm. I haven't won it yet. Still have to win the technical piece, but assuming I win the technical piece, I can win the business piece with those three components.
Beautiful. So the only thing that's left to stick a thorn in our side is the competition.
Right. Exactly. And I think, I don't know if MedPick always had the second C on it with the competition, but I do think it's really important, because this is a way to test a champion. If you have a champion, because oftentimes, how many times as a sales manager do you hear a team tell you, oh yeah, no, they won't tell me who's in the deal? Like, well, then do you have a real champion? Because a real champion would tell you, hey, listen, okay, so I really like what you guys are doing. I'm going to bat for you, but here's what you're up against. That's a real champ. That's a way to test the champion. So if they won't tell you who's in there, it might be because the company really has a policy not to do that. And that's okay. Like, you might not be able to get around that. But if they don't have that policy and they don't tell you, that should be a little bit of a yellow flag. Why are they not? Are they really my champion? Because now I don't know who I'm up against. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, even if they won't tell me, I can infer based on what they're asking me. So when they ask for certain things, which I won't disclose because I'm too competitive, and in case a competitor listens to this, I don't want them to know, but I can hear based on what they're asking me who's in the account. And I'm like, I'm 99% sure it's this. This is how we're going to go against it. Mm-hmm. So knowing the competition is going to help you set the decision criteria. That's what's going to really tie into that, right? Because that's where that lockout document comes into play and really positioning yourself better than who else is in there.
100%. I can, as you were saying, no, you can relate. I remember I used to sell diesel generators up against Cat. Cat and Cummins were two of the bigger ones. And we were a small mom and pop firm here in Vancouver. And I can't remember which one it was, but as soon as they talked about, it was something to do with like power, like response time based on a certain rated load. I'm like, you've been talking to Cat.
Yep.
Okay. I was like, you're talking to Cindy at Cat too, aren't you? I'm like, I know it. I'm like, I know she deals in this size. I'm like, okay, so now I know exactly who I'm up against. It's like, okay, my playbook is changing because.
No, that's exactly right. Like sometimes all you need to do is listen to the language they're using. And if someone else has set the agenda or someone else has gotten in there, you can pretty much unpack. And my team is all very attuned to that. We're all salespeople. We're very competitive and we want every advantage we can possibly have against being the competition. So, and then to go with the scoring on competition, zero is you don't know who they are. One, you might suspect who they are based on inference. And two is you've actually been told.
Gotcha.
So that's pretty straightforward. And then what we've done, so you guys will have the screenshot, what we've put in Salesforce. What's been very helpful for us is we had our IT team put these metrics into Salesforce, and the reps can put the score on them. So the reps would put the 0, the 1, or the 2. So I have to assume that they're right. And sometimes I do have to question, is that really a 2 when we do deal reviews? So I use MedPick to do the deal reviews on our larger opportunities. That's separate than forecast calls. But if it's a large opportunity and I want to put multiple heads together to kind of strategize on how to win, we'll use MedPick as the framework. And then it's scored 0, 1, or 2. What Salesforce does automatically is it will add up the total score, and it'll give me a red light, a green light, or a yellow light, depending on what that score is. I'm trying to think of exactly what the it's like, if it's 14 to 16 or whatever, that there's a high end range and then there's a mid range and lower range. I can get that to you guys, but because we've been doing it as the score, the red light and green, I know that if it's in one of those ranges, like if it's red, that's very far from a commit deal. Mm-hmm. If it's green, then I'm really digging into like what's left, what's standing between us here and closing then, because most of the deals are obviously going to sit in yellow because they're probably stage 3, stage 4, where you don't have everything necessarily lined up yet. Mm-hmm. But MedPick, and I've talked to other leaders who have done the scoring in the same way, and they've been able to say, if that score is a 15, I know I'm going to win that deal. And as long as the rep has the right close date in, I know that's a committable deal. So you can really, as long as the team is disciplined about it, and what we do is we use Clary as our forecasting tool. I bring that score into my Clary view. So I see the opportunity, I see the dollar amount, I see the close date, obviously who's running with the deal, and then we'll also see what that MedPick score is so that I can correlate that as I'm asking questions to really understand where are we falling short and what do we need to do next there. So that's kind of been a nice process for us to make sure we're using it, because this is really easy for reps just to ignore and not do. But because it's front and center on their forecast, if it's a 0, it's not acceptable to have like a 0 score on a MedPick, because like what? I don't need a rep to have a 0. So like, where are we at in the deal? And that's been a way for us to kind of keep it going once we kind of trained the team on this process.
Gotcha. So you're doing regular check-ins on each of these deals for, you know, where are they in the process? Do they really belong there? And what is their MedPick score?
Yeah, I really just incorporate it in terms of the forecast call every week. So my managers have the forecast call with their direct reports. The frontline managers have it, and then all the way up. And then I do the forecast call with my direct reports, who are almost all second line managers. And then they'll report back kind of where we're at, what the holes are, what are we doing next to fill the holes in the deals. And I get through as many as I can. I go top down for like an hour and a half. But I like to know everything about my deals. Like if anyone asks me about it, like I want to know where it is, what I'm missing, and how I'm going about it. So I like the team to, because I think the more we know where the gap is, the quicker I can fill it. And then if I need to report to C staff or whatnot, then I pretty much know where I'm at on all my opportunities.
That's phenomenal. How small of an opportunity would you use something like MedPick on? Like how low do you guys, does your team go? Yeah.
That's a good question. So I have my AEs, my account executives, they're kind of hybrid inside sales, hybrid reps. I really have them do anything that's over $12,000 ARR.
Okay.
And then obviously the field deals are all bigger than that. So anything over 12,000 ARR, I do like them to have a MedPick on it. Definitely over 60K. Anything over 60K has to have a score. If there's some that between 1 and 5, I'll just push on the managers to be like, hey, listen, looks like we've got some, like, you got to go dig in. I don't go below. We do everything in MRR. So I know I keep flipping between the two. Most people don't think in MRR, but we still do, because we do monthly deals. Sometimes, I mean, I don't, but the long tail does monthly deals. I just lost my train of thought on that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Because basically, underneath $12,000, it's really more of a transactional sale. It's not a full, you know, Miller Hyman solution sale that you're going to get in and really, it's probably going to close in a couple of weeks. They're going to might even pay on a credit card.
Yeah. I mean, it's debatable between 1 and 5K MRR if we need to MedPick them, but sometimes that's what the team has. And if that's what that territory has, then I expect them to know those opportunities in depth. If it's over 60K MRR, I definitely want them to have 60K ARR. I want them to have a score on it and really know where they're at in the deal, because that starts to become a material difference to me in the pipeline. Those really add up. Like if a 1K deal is off, I mean, it's kind of a rounding error. But if a 25K MRR deal is off, that's a big difference. Mm-hmm. So I cannot afford to have those not know where they are. So if it's over 5K MRR or 60K ARR, that's where I absolutely dig in and make sure I've got the MedPix score. And I'm a little bit looser between the one and the five, because you're right. A lot of those are quarter and quarter, and that'll slow the deal down. And I don't want to do that. In fact, with my Velocity team, so I have a team for under 100 employees. That Velocity team does not use MedPix. They use Bant.
Okay.
Budget Authority need timeline, because their deals are just like they're called, Velocity. They're very fast. And this would slow them down. And that's not necessary for a deal of that type. But for my territories, I definitely use it. But for Velocity, I expose them to it, but I don't ask them to use it.
That's fair. Yeah, I think it's a helpful, just for career progression, to have an understanding of if I want to move from a high velocity sale to move up in the big leagues, where you're closing, you know, multi-$100,000 deals, $1 million deals, you know, this is what's coming next.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And we do a really, I think like Salesforce does. Salesforce does a phenomenal job. There's a lot of companies that do a really good job of hiring everything from interns to promoting them to SDRs to small business to territories and to field reps. And I think we've really built that system here and given people a lot of opportunities to do that. So I do like them exposed to what's going on in the next role so that they can hit the ground running. So I do think it's good for exposure and career development, but I don't think it makes sense for day-to-day usage in a high velocity sale.
I agree. If I'm buying something for $99 a month, I don't want to go through all of this with the person who's trying to sell me something.
No,
that just sounds...
that's not what we want either.
Yeah.
It's painful. We want to reduce friction. So we want to help the customer buy whatever way is easiest for them in that group. This is way too heavyweight for that team.
Perfect. Jamie, my mind is blown. I feel like I've learned so much today. I do have one last question just to close it out. And I know we talked about, you know, results so far, but I'd love already at the top of the episode, but I'd love if we just kind of went back into that. So going through this process, so what was the before and after in terms of, if you can share sort of what was forecast accuracy before and then since you implemented this?
After, yeah. So before, the forecast was being missed by, oh my gosh, I don't even know if I can do that percentage off the top of my head. I almost had to do the math. It was off by a very large percentage, shall we say.
Okay.
25%. It was a big percentage miss. That is not acceptable to me. I go by industry standard. You want to be within 5%. And so for most of the quarters, we've been within 1% of that since implementing this. Mm-hmm. Two of the quarters, I was within 5%, which I wasn't happy with, but it was close enough. It was close, but it wasn't perfect. In both instances, actually, it had to do not with my MedPix deals. I nailed those. It was the high velocity business. In one case, we had a couple changes that dropped off the velocity business in a way we hadn't anticipated. And I missed that 4% because I just didn't get the online business that we were anticipating. That really taught me to watch there. Now we watch some leading indicators on that a lot more closely. And I have the data team watching it as well, so that if I start seeing some leading indicators on the drop, I can start adjusting my forecast beforehand. And the other time, inversely, I had that business take off in a way that we hadn't been anticipating. And so I missed on the high side. Now I'll miss on the high side all day long. I'm not complaining about that. But on both sides, it was really that squirrely quarter and quarter long tail business has been what's caused me to miss. But I've been very solid on the pipeline MedPix deals. We've done a very good job on those. So I think between 1% and 5% is not too shabby. I think we've done a pretty good job on that. The team's done a phenomenal job of adopting this. And I really attribute, that's not my success. That's really them doing an awesome job of knowing their deals and executing on this. So hands off to my team. If I were gone tomorrow, they'd still be executing on this as if I wasn't here. So hats off to them for really adopting and driving this and doing such a good job.
Well, and it feels like a situation where, again, you've given people the tools and the system that they can plug into and become, you know, and drive excellent results, right?
Which that's, I think,
is the goal of anyone in a sales leadership position.
That's the goal. You can come in, we've got a system, you know what to do, and hopefully you gain some new skills, right? Hopefully it gives you a little bit something new that people can take with them, because I know people aren't going to work at Zendesk forever. So if they've gained some professional advantage by being here, then that carries with them and we've done our job.
There we go. And when they move on to sales leadership roles, you can point to this podcast and say, here's, in case you need a brush up on MedPick.
Yes, exactly. I know. Colin, I really appreciate it. This was phenomenal. I hope I didn't overwhelm everyone. I know that was a lot of information.
It was tons, but you know what? It was necessary for when we come across guests that have this level of information to share. I love going longer and deeper into the subject. So thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right. Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you.